It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's back to when flamingo tongues were normal finger food and boiling water was a sign your morals were slipping. Our guest is food historian Patrick Foss, author of Around the Roman Table, Food and Feasting in Ancient Rome. Then it's decadence and beefcake, road food style, submarine sandwiches and their makers in Atlantic City with the Stearns. Sally Schneider tells why she can't live without her rock, her mortar and pestle. Food writer Ted Lee is stalking the next big taste. And winemaker Randall Graham introduces us to his muse, a Frenchman whose wines are not about taste. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Now sit up straight, Kate. It's time to eat, Pete. Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Get with the gravy, Davey. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato, Plato. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste the bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes, hoping this good food fills you. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills you. Pass me a pancake, Mandrake. Sample a taco, Paco. Have an hors d'oeuvre, Irby. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hannah, Davy, Tommy, Dora, Mandrake. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Pasta, Fazula, Cholula. Oh, do have a bagel, Bagel. Now don't be so bashful, Nashville. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hey, this is a party, Marty. You get the cherry, Jerry. Now look, don't be so picky, Mickey. Everybody eats when they come to my house. All of my friends are welcome. Now don't make me nag ya, mag ya. Eat the tables, the chairs, the napkins, who cares? Eat all my things if they gag ya. Have a frittata, latte. Nibble a kibble, Sybil. Chili con carne for Barney. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Face, Buster, Cher, Chops, Thump. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Steak, cake, pie, sign, juice. When they come to my house. Next Friday night, you're all invited to dance from 8 to 3. All the fishies in the sea are having a ball. It's some affair, they'll all be there from the herring to the whale. They'll turn out to shake a scale in Neptune's hall. Come along and follow me to the bottom of the sea. We'll join in the jamboree at the codfish ball. Lobsters dancing in a row, shuffle off to Buffalo. Jellyfish sway to and fro at the codfish ball. Finn and Hattie lead the eels through an Irish reel. The catfish is a dancing man, but he can't can like the sardine can. Tuna's trucking left and right, snappers tapping, what a night. There won't be a hook in sight at the codfish ball. Octopus and albacore, 50 miles away from shore. Tango cross the ocean floor at the codfish ball. Minnows dance the minuet, barracudas pirouette, while the stingray plays his clarinet at the codfish ball. Scottish salmon form a ring and dance the Highland fling.
The music's hot, so the lock, stock, trot, and the halibut is the jitterbug king. Sing it with me now.
Come along and follow me to the bottom of the sea. We'll join in the jamboree at the cottage ball. Lobsters dancing in a row, a shark bowl on to buffalo. Jellyfish sway to and fro at the cockfish ball. Finn and Hattie lead the eels through an Irish reel. The catfish is a dancing man, but he can't like the sardine can. Tuna's trucking left and right, snappers tapping, what a night. There won't be a hook in sight at the cockfish ball. At the codfish ball.
At the codfish ball. Ya da 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 da.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today we feast in Rome, not the Rome of the popes and pasta. We're talking ancient Rome, where magic and science met at the table. Our guest is historian and chef Patrick Foss. His book is Around the Roman Table, Food and Feasting in Ancient Rome. Cookbook author Sally Schneider reveals the one piece of equipment she can't live without, and it's free. Food writer Ted Lee tells us what he turned up when he set out to find America's next big taste. And then Bonnie Doon Vineyard's Randall Graham introduces us to his new guru, a French winemaker who follows his wine instead of leading it. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, it's Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column for Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, Michael and I were just in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and that's where my family used to visit during the summer. They would stay at one of the big hotels there and eat saltwater taffy and walk on the boardwalk. And it has changed so much. I mean, it's become sort of mini Las Vegas. But the one thing that has stayed the same over the years is the White House sub shop, where you get the greatest sub sandwiches in the world.
Now, this is the submarine sandwich, right?
It is the submarine sandwich. And in fact, legend has it that Tony Bazile, the founder of the White House sub shop, named this sandwich to honor the silent service of World War II, and also because it's shaped like a submarine. But in fact, they claim that they invented the name and the sandwich back in 1946.
I mean, Michael and I have basically been driven insane over the years by, you know, trying to do the semiotics of, you know, what's the difference between a hoagie and a grinder and a sub
and a wedge
and a zeppelin. And basically, they're all the same thing. But in New Jersey, you have to call it a sub.
All right, but now for the uninitiated, exactly what defines that submarine sandwich and
okay.
all those other guys?
Well, the White House is different than any other sub shop because not only are the subs better than anywhere else, but it is really a shrine to sub eating. It's a small place, crowded beyond belief. I mean, the lines are literally around the block. There is an 8x10 glossy of, you know, every person from Frank Sinatra to George the Animal Steele, the wrestler, you know, a signed celebrity photo on the wall of everybody who's ever eaten a White House sub.
And I must say that in addition to the photos, there is the actual towel used by Frank Sinatra in his last performance at a casino in Atlantic City.
To wipe the sub juice?
We don't know
what
he used the towel for, but it is there actually on the wall behind plaster.
Oh, isn't that special? Yeah.
But wait, we have to talk about the subs. We're talking about everything else but
I know.
But the main attraction, which is these fantastic sandwiches. One full-size sub at the White House is a little bit less than a yard-long loaf of really, really good Italian bread cooked that day. They get their bread deliveries several times a day. It's that fresh. And it is loaded with your choice of either cold cuts or such hot things as meatballs or parmesans. We prefer the White House special, which is about 8 different kinds of salami, bologna, cheese, little olive oil,
capicola,
et cetera, lettuce, little bits of sweet pepper. It's huge, and they have a wonderful way of making it while you sit at the counter. They fold all these meats into the sandwich, cut it in half, and serve it on 2 or 3 paper plates because one isn't nearly big enough to hold it.
And also, I just have to say that it's not only a wonderful thing to eat, but I could sit on a counter stool there all day and look at the guys who make the subs. They're all gorgeous.
And they have such style.
They are, right. They're stylish. They have muscles.
And beautiful jewelry.
Beautiful gold jewelry. They're just phenomenal. Well, demigods of the sub shop.
I want an eggplant parmigiano sandwich to go.
That's the place to go.
Right. And I want the guy who makes it.
Thanks, guys.
Bye, Len.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. When we're driving in my Malibu, it's easy to get right next to you. I say, baby, scoot over, please. And then she's right there next to me. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest book in their road food series is Louie's Backyard Cookbook. Well, they show up here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And another thing on the website is the place where you can sign up for our free weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every week, we send you a new recipe for a quick worknight supper. There's technique tips, there's shopping information, and you pay nothing. All you have to do is sign up at splendidtable.org. Expert Sally Schneider is the author of A New Way to Cook. She's always working out new kitchen strategies. Sometimes they're shortcuts, sometimes it's a healthier take on a dish, and sometimes it's a new technique. Hey, Sally, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn.
You know, Sally, I've been talking to people lately about their favorite cooking implement, you know, the thing they don't want to live without. What's yours?
My favorite tool, Lynn, is a mortar and pestle. Which would be very difficult if there were a fire and I was trying to grab it to run out of the house because they're so heavy. Mortars, as you may know, are heavy bowl-like containers in which foods are pounded to puree or ground with a pestle, which is a kind of a club-shaped implement. This is a tool I use in almost all my cooking, and especially in the summer months. It's very primitive, but what it does is it crushes foods. It extracts the flavor from them in a way that is really extraordinarily, that has nothing to do with what a food processor does, with which chops foods. Here we're slowly developing flavors and texture too by pounding and grinding. For example, I might use a pestle for something as simple as bruising herbs to activate their oils and their flavors before I throw them into a dish. or to just lightly pound garlic to loosen the skins to peel it. Garlic is a fabulous example of the difference. When you crush garlic with a pestle, you get a smooth, mellow flavor. When you grind it in a food processor, you get its fire and a kind of acrid quality. So often I'll use my, it's really the pestle that is the key to this. I'll use it to crush the garlic and add the garlic perhaps to a sauce I've made in the processor. Where the key point is that the garlic needs to be done by hand and the rest doesn't.
So this old controversy about making pesto, and people say if you make it in the food processor, it never tastes the way it does when you make it in a mortar and pestle. You believe that's true then?
I do. I've tried it side by side. I did an experiment after I came back from Liguria, where we did a study of pestos, and I tasted them side by side after I had made them in a processor and by hand. There's a huge difference. Now, you may think it's a lot of work, but the trick is to have the right mortar and the right pestle that will make short work of it. I love also mortars and pestles to use in ways that aren't traditional, beyond the traditional aioli or mayonnaise. For example, I will take beans I've cooked and coarsely crush them to use in a bruschetta. So they get this very kind of peasant quality, very rustic quality, and then drizzle some olive oil on it. I use a pestle all the time for pitting olives and cherries, for example. And I use olives frequently in my cooking or to make olive pastes and so on. One of the most fabulous things is to make a quick flavored oil. And I learned this, Lynn, by when I was in the south of France and we had this huge mortar in the courtyard of the house I lived in. The artist I was with and I were having a party, we made a huge soup, but more and more people kept coming and the soup was getting thinner and thinner as I was trying to make it go far enough. And I thought, I'll make a flavored oil. I grabbed herbs, lavender, thyme, garlic that was growing around the house, pounded them in the mortar with my pestle, which was a stone I had found on the beach because the house didn't have a pestle in it. Into an incredibly fragrant oil, using, of course, extra virgin olive oil. And I got three guys to carry the huge mortar in on the table, and everybody spooned the fragrant oil into the hot soup. It exploded in this aroma of herbs, and everybody thought I'd made this fabulous soup, which in effect was a very watery soup. So that is also where I learned about makeshift mortars and pestles. After I picked up that stone on the beach, I said, you know, it's really a pounding device. So what else can I use? I've used doorknobs, old wooden doorknobs, when I've been staying in a house, actually, in West Virginia, where I go to kind of retreat. Stones, meat pounders can be great. You don't have to have a mortar. You can pound right on the counter, on a piece of marble, or even in a stainless steel bowl. So it's not a tool that you have to go out and buy if you don't want to, but it's a tool that you can work into your everyday life that I think is just fantastic.
Well, I'm going to go out and hunt for a rock. Thank you, Sally.
You're welcome.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. Now, once you find your rock, initiate it with Sally's recipe for warm olive vada. It's on the website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, feasting on flamingo tongues and forbidden water in ancient Rome, tomorrow's next big taste, and open lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget. We don't eat giraffes, at least not usually. We are civilized folks. We know what we should eat. We know it should be healthy. We know it should be civilized. And we love it if our food is alluring and delicious and maybe just a tad taboo. Now, in ancient Rome, those same forces shaped how people ate, but with very different results. Our guest, Patrick Foss, is an expert on the subject. He's a food historian and chef and author of Around the Roman Table, Food and Feasting in Ancient Rome. He talks to us from Amsterdam. Patrick, welcome.
Hello. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So, Patrick, the beliefs of the Romans about food, what were those beliefs and how did they shape the food that they ate?
Well, of course, they were not Christians. They had many, many gods, and that meant that they ate practically everything. They had their taboos, but those taboos were related to specific feasts, for instance. Americans, for Thanksgiving, they will always eat turkey. Well, likewise, on certain feasts, the Romans would eat certain dishes related to the god. So, for instance, on the feast of Mars, you would eat horse. On the feast of Venus, you would eat a cow. And also, not all of the gods got along. So, for instance, the feast of Bonadea, who was an alcoholic goddess and got beaten by her husband, it wouldn't be appropriate to eat anything that is symbolic of love, because she had a very bad love relationship. So, for instance, no myrtle on the feast of the Bonadea. The taboo was related to the specific day and the specific god being honored.
What about the health factors? What governed what was considered healthful?
Well, I suppose you could compare Roman medicine a little bit to contemporary Chinese medicine in that it was a mix of magic and science. The magical traditions were very much, again, related to those gods. Every plant, every animal was dedicated to a certain god and therefore had certain rituals involved with the preparation as well. But in the same time, the Hippocrates in the 5th century before Christ started inventing a structure to try and make sense of this. And he came up with the humor theory, which was basically relating the conditions of the human body to the four elements, which is fire, earth, air, water. Mm-hmm. So all those four elements should be in balance with each other. And all those four elements would also relate to flavors, like fire would be bitter. And that would relate to certain astrological signs like Aries, Leo, Sagittarius, and to certain gods. So, for instance, horse meat would be a fiery kind of food. So if you wanted somebody to be more aggressive, you would feed them horse. If you want someone to be more loving, you would feed them sweet things and water. So the conditioning of the food was very much determined still by the old religion, but structured by Hippocrates into this new Greek system, and that lived in Rome alongside with the old magical traditions. And in the end, what they always wanted is a balance. And this balance had to be there in the meal as well. So there had to be a balance between all the flavors. And just like in China, you will find that they will use sweet, sour, bitter ingredients in one dish in order to balance it all out and nothing be absent from it. The Romans would do the same.
Uh-huh.
So in that sense, it's very different also from modern Italian cooking. Modern Italian cooking is very, into purism, into simplicity and minimalism, if you like. One spice already on an Italian dish is a lot. But the Romans would prefer 20 spices on a dish because that would provide so many different aspects and flavorings that I think, well, there's more balance in that probably.
Uh-huh.
So if anything, you could probably compare Roman cuisine and definitely Roman sauces to Indian curries rather than to the modern way Italians make their food.
Patrick, they seemed like they were so open-minded about their eating. I mean, was there anything that was considered decadent, considered just you didn't do that?
Well, I don't know. The Romans were very moralist as well, and things that sound really decadent to us, like the trunk of an elephant or a giraffe or the brains of a parrot or the tongue of a flamingo, sounds really weird. But if you consider the fact that they already invaded Africa in the 2nd century before Christ, these foods were part of their empire. That was kind of their back garden. That was normal to them. What they thought was decadent were things like fish pate, oysters, artichokes, you know, which is basically a big thistle, which was very expensive. Or things like boiled water. Nero used to boil his water and then cool it down again. Now, we think that's very sensible, but the Romans thought that was absolutely debauched and lynched their emperor for it.
You know, there's one thing out of ancient Rome that everybody talks about. It's salty. It's called garum, and supposedly it stunk of rotting fish.
Yeah, it sounds
pretty
bad.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, fermentation, of course, is, you know, one of the eldest forms of, you know, food preparation. Let's not forget that. You know, we don't get our cheese, we don't get our wine without fermentation. But yes, this is a sauce made of rotting fish, which was very shocking to people in the 19th century. And they thought, like, Roman cuisine must have been absolutely disgusting. But nowadays, with the Eastern Asian cuisines becoming more popular, we get acquainted again with fish sauces. And in Japan, Buddhism is kind of altered the fish sauce into soy sauce, which is a vegetarian equivalent of the same thing. And fish sauces and soy sauce have one thing in common, which is a very high content of monosodium glutamate. So now suddenly we realize that why the Romans used this fish sauce in nearly every dish, including sweet dishes, is basically as a flavor enhancer.
So it had MSG in it.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why they put it on everything. And we still do that again nowadays. Since you know, the chemical was distilled in the 20s, you know, we put it in our stock cubes, and therefore it goes into nearly every stock in every restaurant and goes into every sauce once again. So we're back at the Romans.
You know, they were really out there. Hey, Patrick, thank you.
They were ahead of their time.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Lynn.
Patrick Foss is author of Around the Roman Table, Food and Feasting in Ancient Rome. You can get his recipe for soft-boiled eggs in pine nut sauce. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? On the website, splendidtable.org. In business, fortunes are made or lost in knowing what the next big thing is going to be. Well, in the food business, you make your fortune if you know what the next big flavor is going to be. Food writers Ted and Matt Lee, brothers who write for the New York Times and other national publications, have been doing some research. Ted Lee joins us. Ted, good to have you back on the show.
Thanks so much, Lynn.
So, Ted, how does one set out to find the next big flavor?
Well, we just started calling people and thinking, well, chefs are going to know something about that, and growers certainly. And, you know, as soon as we started making calls, we got more ideas, like, let's call someone who's involved in making natural or artificial flavors. So it was really sort of just going to the people we thought would have some sense of what's coming next.
So who'd you hit up?
The first person we turned to was Marcus Samuelson, a chef at the restaurant Aquavit in Manhattan. And he was born in Ethiopia, grew up in Sweden, and we just thought he would have a global perspective on things. And his choice for the next big flavor was berbere spice, which is an Ethiopian spice blend that's just fantastic. And it was new to me. I'd heard the word before, but even in a specialty gourmet store, it's a difficult thing to find.
What is it exactly?
What it is a blend of as many as 11 different spices, but commonly fenugreek, always chilies, toasted and ground ginger, garlic, cardamom. I mean, it's all the aromatic, wonderful, wonderful spices. And it looks a lot like just paprika. It's got a brown orange character. The one we had was very fine. and it's just delicious. It has, if you smell it, it has a smell of sort of roasted or dried fruit. But you can also sense a sort of sinus tickling chili. It's very hot.
So who was next on the list?
Next on the list was Alice Waters of Chez Panisse in Berkeley. We were curious because we know she's especially interested in heirloom varieties of fruits and vegetables, and we figured she would have a great response. And she did. It was mulberry. A little bit surprising response in that, you know, I think of mulberry sort of as, sort of nuisance fruit. It's always underfoot and getting stuck in your boots and you're tracking it everywhere. And I hadn't ever really considered the flavor as something to cook with, certainly. And she had said she uses a mulberry syrup, which is common in Middle Eastern cuisine. And so we went to a Middle Eastern grocer and found some mulberry syrup, and it was delicious, very subtle. And we eventually came to a recipe, that was a duck that was slow roasted with bearberry spice, and then in the last hour was glazed with mulberry syrup.
That sounds good.
It was delicious.
Now, what about the scientific end of this? Where did you go for that?
We went to a flavorist, is what they're called. He's a guy named Gary Rabb, a senior flavorist at Wild Flavors in Kentucky, which is an enormous, German-based company that makes flavorings for the candy beverage industry. You know, they put the sour cherry in gummy bears and things like that, and the beef in bouillon cubes. And he said that what he called sweet heat would take over. And that is chilies in combination with fruit flavors. You know, there are already chili lime tortilla chips out there. And he was saying, now, if you take that chili lime and put it in a gummy bear, it's delicious. And he had also mentioned a company in California was doing, I believe it was a mango jalapeno iced tea, if you can believe it. And he was, you know, saying that they would be flavors that were familiar to us, but in combinations that were completely new.
This is interesting because so much of what you are talking about is, first of all, not about Western world flavors, but very reminiscent of the ethnic mix in this country.
Absolutely, Lynn. And that's what everyone we contacted said, that that all the flavors of the future were coming from Latin American cuisines, Asian cuisines, you know, the Ethiopian. And actually, one of Marcus Samuelson's predictions was that a Pan-African cuisine would emerge in the next 15 years as popular as, you know, Indian or Southeast Asian is now. And a fruit grower we talked to said that everyone's calling him about kaffir lime leaves, which are, you know, the leaves of the kaffir lime tree, which we very often encounter in Thai cuisine. But he was saying that we were going to use kaffir lime in the future in things like chocolate pudding, you know, sort of American comfort foods, Western comfort foods. So I think the flavors are, you're right, I think they are mostly coming from outside of North America.
Well, I know right now all the marketeers are making notes furiously. Ted, thank you.
I hope so. Thank you, Lynn. Enjoyed it.
Ted and Matt Lee's article, The Next Big Taste, originally appeared in the New York Times Magazine. Now, Ted left us with their recipe for roast duck with bebera and mulberry glaze. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Randall Graham is creator of Bonnie Doon Vineyard, a label that's known for its wacky names, its graphics, and its unconventional approach to the wine business. Randall looks at wine like an artist looks at a canvas. Every now and then, we like to check in with him to get a glimpse of the world behind that glass of Zinfandel. Randall, welcome.
Thanks very much.
I understand that there is someone who's having a very strong influence on you at this point. It's someone in the Loire Valley. Can you tell me about this person?
Sure. I met this fellow rather by accident in Belgium about 6 months ago. He's a winemaker in the coldest part of the Loire, and a guy by the name of Claude Courtois. What's interesting about this fellow, when you look at him, he's an enormous man, big, bushy beard, Rasta hair. He looks like he could live in a bus in Santa Cruz, no problem at all. He's rather quixotic, which is to say he's growing oddball grape varieties and very challenging grape varieties in the coldest part of the Loire. And he's using biodynamic practices. These are sort of quasi-mystical organic practices based on the teachings of Rudolf Steiner. They really try to permit the winemaker or the grape grower to use the forces of nature as an ally. So in other words, the various agricultural operations are done in sync with the natural forces, tides, lunar cycles, sun, solar cycles, and things like that. And he also basically just doesn't listen to anyone but himself. For example, he doesn't use sulfur dioxide in his wines, which is sort of one of the cardinal tenets of commercial winemaking.
Now, why do you use sulfur dioxide?
Sulfur dioxide is a fairly obnoxious chemical, but it does keep wines fresh. It keeps them from oxidizing, and it prevents microbial degradation of the wine.
Uh-huh. Okay, so it keeps it from spoiling.
Yes, exactly. But he doesn't care. He doesn't care. He makes wines to please himself, and he, more importantly, instead of making wines with an eye towards their commercial viability, what's important to him is that his own life be folded into the natural process.
So how is this expressed?
Well, for example, he is very unhappy with the way that grapevines are pruned and trained, so he's invented a system of his own which he believes captures cosmic energy. It's in the form of an arc, so that geometry apparently is very conducive to trapping cosmic energy. And he also really, the vines are headed very, very low, so he's trying to pump minerals from out of the soil, so his wines have a very strong mineral character to them.
What do they taste like?
Well, they're somewhat tragically flawed. They're all a little bit oxidized, sort of vin jaune-like, but they're very concentrated and have wonderful minerality. They're really, really captivating.
Mm. So what does this mean to you? What is it?
Well, I'm not sure I'm ready to incorporate all of his practices into my winemaking. Certainly, our customers would be in for a very rude shock if I were to do so. Mm-hmm. But I am going to farm our grapes biodynamically. I think that's a really, really clever way to grow grapes. Using cover crops to really work with the vines. It's also just sort of respecting the intelligence of the vines, rather than really forcing them to behave a certain way, really observing what exactly they need and trying to meet their needs. I am working on really trying to capture more minerality in our wines. I think that's really what makes wines interesting.
When you say minerality, do you mean more of the taste of the soil?
Definitely, exactly.
Thanks, Randall.
My pleasure.
Randall Graham is creator and winemaker of California's Bonnie Doon Vineyard. Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia question. Now, this week it's, what is the classic New Orleans cure for a hangover? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. online at target.com/supertarget. Well, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the classic New Orleans cure for a hangover? It's the Ramos Fizz. Technically, the Ramos Gin Fizz. New Orleans believes this is the drink for the morning after, and I believe it's a great cocktail for brunch. Henry Ramos created it in New Orleans in the 1800s. Now, people there are very touchy about this drink. First, get the name right. It is not just a gin fizz. It is a Ramos gin fizz. Second, you'd better make it right. The way they do it at the Fairmont Hotel, where the Ramos is practically sanctified, is that you shake together ice, gin, lemon and lime juice, sugar syrup, milk, egg white, make it pasteurized, please, and orange flower water. You strain that into a glass, you top it with club soda, and you serve it. No garnish and never an ice cube. Since New Orleans is a place where the hangover is not unknown, I trust their medical advice. Everyone there says the secret to the cure is the orange flower water. A few drops make a huge difference in your outlook.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Michaela on the line. Michaela, what do you want to talk about?
I wanted to talk, Lynn, about vegetarian gourmet cooking. We've been vegetarians for about 20-some years, and my husband and I love to entertain. And we're kind of uninspired. So I'm wondering if you can recommend any gorgeous, inventive, gourmet vegetarian dishes, recipes, or if you have like a favorite source book.
Uh-huh. Okay. And by the way, everybody runs dry.
Right.
You hit the wall periodically.
It's true. When you have a success, you sort of want to stick with it.
Yeah. But let me ask you this. You eat absolutely nothing that comes from an animal, or do you eat dairy?
We eat dairy, and actually we do beyond that. We occasionally eat fish.
Aha. Okay. A fish bistilla. Have you ever heard of bistilla? It's also called bistella. It comes from Morocco?
No.
Oh, let me describe this. This is one of the world's great dishes. Now, most people hear about it made with chicken, but I could swear there is a fish version of it.
Okay.
It is a flaky pastry. You make it with phyllo dough. You know, where you lay out the phyllo dough and you brush it with a bit of butter and you can sprinkle it with some crumbs and then you lay layer after layer. So that this is the outside. It's a pie. It's done in about like a 12-inch skillet. It's when you get all done, you have these layers and layers of phyllo dough and they're about, the pie is 12 inches in diameter and about 3 inches thick. And enclosed in it is a sweet savory combination. You would have eggs that you have scrambled in a flavorful, let's say in this case, perhaps a vegetable broth that has a ton of garlic in it and a ton of fresh coriander. You drain those eggs. So now you have these gorgeous golden curds with this fabulous flavor. Oh, there's a lot of lemon juice in the broth too. So you have this lemony quality. A layer of that goes in. There's roasted almonds that you coarsely crush. There's sugar. There is cinnamon, would you believe? And then there would be fish that would be flavored with Moroccan spices in there. And you serve this hot, and one of the traditional ways of eating this is that you actually eat it with your fingers. Oh, I forgot to tell you, this goes back to the early Arab periods when you had these incredible sweet savory combinations. Before you serve it, you sprinkle it with sugar, and then you dust it with little lines of cinnamon. So you have the spice of the garlic and the lemon and the cumin and the coriander, and there may be some tomato in there. And then you've got the contrast of those roasted almonds, and you've got the little bit of sugar, and you've got the cinnamon. It is a stunning dish, and a lot of people have never seen it. It will be a new experience. So that's one
fabulous
thing.
Fabulous. Where would I find a recipe for bistia?
One of the best places to go is Paula Wolfert. W-O-L-F-E-R-T.
Mm-hmm.
And she did a book, and this was done in the 70s, but it is still in print because it's good.
Oh,
it
good.
Was called Couscous and Other Good Food from Morocco.
Ah.
It's out in paperback, and I would bet you, by the way, you could probably find it in the library, mm-hmm. and you might find it secondhand, you know, online at like half.com.
Right.
Now, she has other recipes in there as well, because one of the great things about Moroccan food is there's a lot of meatless material there.
Wonderful.
And, oh, the flavors are fabulous.
It sounds wonderful. You're amazing. No, I love how you do this off the cuff.
No, because this is one of the dishes I used to love to do. I used to do a chicken version of it. All you need is this and some greens, because it's so spectacular.
Oh, great. Well, I want to thank you for your show, and I want to thank the Stearns, Jane and Michael, who I remember from Reading, Connecticut years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're fabulous people.
Well, thanks for the kind words, and hey, enjoy.
Thank you so much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You can call us, guys. 800-537-5252. We've got Neil calling. Neil, pressing issue, or just would you just like to schmooze a little bit?
Actually trying to find out about probably one of the most politically incorrect substances on Earth.
Which is?
Lard.
Oh, yeah.
Julia Child was right on the money when she lamented the fact when McDonald's stopped cooking their french fries in lard.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing seems to go better with potatoes than frying them in oil.
Yeah, and pastry.
Lard.
Yeah, and pie crust, too, you know. And, well, don't get me started. I love lard.
Right, exactly. Hog fat rules and all that.
Yeah, exactly.
I have heard that there is this ultra-premium lard called foil that I believe is made from the lining of the pancreas or something like that. Does it
foil.
Exist? Is it worth finding, and where would I look for it?
Now, where did you hear that? Because there is a premium kind of lard. You're talking to a woman, by the way, who actually at one point used to teach classes on how to cook, use every part of the pig, and used to go into a dissertation about the different kinds of fat in the different parts of the pig and how they melted. This could change the world as we know it. But I've never heard the term foil lard. Where did you come across it?
My partner has a zillion cookbooks and magazines and everything else, and I think that's where I heard it.
Aha. Well, you know,
so I don't. That's the thing. I'm trying to track down an elusive kind of thing, but
well,
it's supposed to be the cat's meow, so to speak.
Right. The tantamount of all the paragon.
Right.
I have a sneak. Follow me on this one because this is interesting. I think this may be an interesting connection. Supposedly, the most sought after fat in the pig for creamy melting, you know, to melt down into just a lush, wonderful, fabulous tasting, delicate liquid, is called leaf lard, and it's from inside the loin, which is kind of the middle of the pig.
Okay.
It comes mainly from around the kidney. Okay. Now, what's interesting is if you translate the word leaf into French, it's feuille. And I just wonder if by some chance it turned into foil.
That could very well be.
But it is the lard or the fat that sits around the kidney area.
The kidneys?
Yes.
Okay,
and it
so
is
that's close to the pancreas.
That's very close to the pancreas,
okay,
if I remember my...
So there's some truth to what I...
Yes, exactly. The other area that's extremely sought after in terms of producing wonderful lard is to melt down the belly. It's this hard fat that's right under the skin of the belly, and then there's sort of a line of lean, and then under that there is a softer fat, and you can just, you know, put that in a pan with a little water and let it melt and let it melt and let it melt, and you remove the little nubbins of meat, and you're off and running. But now the key is, and by the way, you've probably learned this, the worst lard you can buy is that awful hydrogenated stuff that comes in bricks in the supermarket. I mean, that's just not worth putting in your mouth. But the problem is, do you know a butcher where you can at least get the fat?
Well, that's what I was wondering. Where would I find such luscious stuff?
Now,
so it would be from, like, a butcher who cares kind of thing?
Well, yeah, or a butcher who's doing sort of old world stuff, you know, a Mexican meat store, a German, an Italian. Where do you live?
Charlotte, North Carolina.
Well, now, Charlotte, gosh, you know, you guys have got great pig out there.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, I've got an idea. Oh, by the way, I mean, you could actually go to the supermarket and see if you can order it. You know, just say, can you guys bring in a special order for me? I want all the fat from around the kidney, and no doubt whoever you deal with in terms of getting your pig, maybe I can get that. But you know what occurs to me, too? The big barbecue places there, the places that do fabulous barbecue, because if they're using locally slaughtered pigs.
Whole hog, right?
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, somebody could be throwing this in the freezer for you.
Right.
And then you get a bunch of it. Yeah, you get a bunch of it, you melt it down yourself, and then you freeze it yourself, and you've got your lard for a year.
Wow.
Okay, so talk to barbecue people. Anybody who's doing any kind of butchering, any high-end meat market can probably get their hands on it, too. Yeah. It's called leaf lard. It's the fat from around the kidney or belly.
Okay.
Okay?
Excellent.
You take care.
All right, thank you.
Bye, Neil.
Bye.
Okay, please. Nobody is going to call me about this, raving about lard and how terrible it is. It's delicious. And an occasional taste of the really fine stuff. Okay? All right. Now, you can call us to chat about anything else. 800-537-5252. We have Donna waiting. Hey, Donna, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about low country cuisine today.
Aha! Why low country cuisine?
Well, I'm a culinary professional, and in my store we carry a barbecue sauce that says low country on it.
Right.
And some of our guests have been asking what it is, and I am not familiar with it and was wondering what it's all about.
Well, you're talking to a woman who is, the term would be hot off the boat. We were there on a holiday recently and for a conference. The low country is referring to the coastal area and essentially the sort of plain area of parts of North Carolina, all of South Carolina, and parts of Georgia. So it's this coastal area. Another word for it might be swampy.
Really?
Yeah. And Charleston and Savannah are kind of the capitals, the co-capitals. It's an area that has always had an immensely rich food tradition because both of those cities, going back to the 1600s, have been major trading ports. And it is a place where the seafood is stunning. The main, essentially the main starches would be grits. Okay, but delicious grits.
Okay.
Grits done with a combination of sweet corn as well as the corn you normally would use for cornmeal, you know, that isn't sweet, and rice. It was an area that for about 100, 150 years produced what was considered by some to be the most sought after long grain rice in the entire world. It was called Carolina Gold, and there is still some rice production down there. And a great rice tradition from baking with it to cooking with it. Great reference books, by the way. Since you're selling a low country product, you may want to sell one of the great books on the area about the area.
Okay.
There's a man named Hoppin John Taylor, or John Martin Taylor. He has got to be the leading authority, the leading food historian of the area, and he's a wonderful cook. And he did a book called Hoppin John's Low Country Cooking.
Oh, fabulous.
It'll tell you everything you want to know, much more than I can ever relate
to
you.
Oh, good.
But the food is wonderful. It's famous for its shrimp. Fried food down there. I just never put anything in my mouth that was not well done. I mean, the fried food was the paragon. And a lot of beautiful old plantation dishes, you know, fancy food.
So as a food person, I ought to hop on the next plane and get down there.
You
huh?
ought to. I have to tell you, go to Charleston and then go out on the islands. And the Gullah people are there. These are the ancestors or the descendants of the black slaves that were brought in to work the rice. And they have their own language. The food is wonderful. The culture is fascinating. You could spend a very long time exploring. But start out with Low Country Cooking by John Martin Taylor.
Terrific.
Hey. Hey, thanks for an interesting question.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
All righty.
Talk about hitting a nerve. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Myron Olson is a courageous man. While other cheesemakers focus on lovable cheddar, chic little Brie's, Myron has spent 30 years producing the hardest sell in the cheese business. Myron is a certified master cheesemaker at the Chalet Cheese Co-op near Monroe, Wisconsin. Myron, thanks for talking with us.
Yes, hello.
Myron, I understand that you make a cheese that's pretty rare these days. What is it?
Yes, we are the last Limburger cheese factory left in the United States.
Uh-huh. Now, I understand there was a time, though, where Wisconsin produced a great deal of Limburger.
Yes, You go back to the 1920s and the 1930s, national production of Limburger was up around 11 million pounds, and Wisconsin was the biggest producer of it. At one time in Wisconsin, there was over 100 plants producing Limburger cheese.
So what happened?
People's taste changed. They were introduced more to mild cheese. The high-flavor cheese, even like the Swiss cheese, kind of went by the wayside. The two things with Limburger, it's a high-flavor cheese. On a scale of 1 to 10, it's an 11 when it's very old. and also the infamous aroma that comes off of Limburger.
How would you describe that aroma?
A bit of the countryside aroma to it. It's an earthy smell to it. If you drive by a barn, a farming operation, that is part of the smell that you will incur.
I think you did that so delicately. That's one of the best descriptions I've ever heard.
In other words, without saying that it's stinky.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, Limburger has become almost a pop icon. There have been popular songs about it. I mean, it's the cheese everybody loves to hate. So who is buying the Limburger?
Our main force, people that buy the Limburger, it's an older generation that has learned what Limburger is about. But we also see kind of a skipping of generations. What you hear is, I used to go over to Grandpa's, and we would try his Limburger. And so the grandkids kind of have learned to eat Limburger. It's kind of a cheese that you need a mentor for. But if you go from Wisconsin to New York, that area of the country,
uh-huh.
That's our main distribution area. And for some reason, Florida is real high on Limburger also. Just might have something to do with all the retired people down there.
How do you like to eat your Limburger?
You take a dark bread, like a rye bread or a pumpernickel,
mm-hmm.
Got a couple of nice slices of Limburger, nice thick slices, nice thick slice of a sweet onion, and then you can either put mustard, mayonnaise. We have one gentleman in town, he eats it with toast and strawberry or grape jelly every morning for breakfast.
Mm.
And what you try and do is it's intensification of flavors. You've got the dark bread, you've got the Limburger, you have the sweet onion. Then, of course, you wash it down with a good beer, good cold beer.
Sounds great to me. Myron, thank you very much.
Alrighty, you bet.
Myron Olson is the cheesemaker at Chalet Cheese Cooperative in Monroe, Wisconsin. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from T.S. Eliot. He said, "Never commit yourself to a cheese without having first examined it." The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. You can find everything you heard here and so much more on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, don't miss out on our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and we hope it helps make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online at splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.